Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
I suspect intuitively we all understand that stress is wreaking havoc in our lives, linked to everything from relationship disruption to obesity and heart disease. Since the 1970s, mental health healers have become big fans of mindfulness as a treatment. What is it? Does it work? Do I need a doctorate to practice it? Time for an open house masterclass. Lisa Aitken is a clinical psychologist specializing in spiritual growth. Lisa begins our masterclass on mindfulness with its origins.
Yes, a lot of people don't realize that is its origins. And one of the premises of Buddhism, not that I'm an expert, but from what I've read, is that suffering comes from attaching to things, and therefore, if you can learn to detach from the world, it's a path to less suffering and enlightenment. And mindfulness is, in that religion, a process of learning to just be in the present moment, where you're just aware, you're not analyzing, you're not judging, you're just aware in a detached sort of way. Now, in the late 70s, there were some psychologists who were practicing Buddhist meditation just themselves and happened to also be looking at stress levels. There was a man called Jon Kabat-Zinn, and he was looking at very stressed people and ways to reduce their stress levels, and started introducing this mindful meditation, this idea of just slowing down and being in the moment. And he started getting amazing results. And so he started mindfulness-based stress reduction courses. They're all over the world now, in hospitals, in medical centers. And then other psychologists, other researchers started to pick that up. And now you've got some of the world's most preeminent neuroscientists and psychologists using it and researching it.
What are the telltale signs of somebody who possesses this unique and rarest of gifts to be able to live in that zone? What does that look like?
Yes, well, it is a practice. It's a discipline. It's something that you learn to do. And then, I guess, like most disciplines, starts to become second nature. It tends to be, in practice, there's two types of mindfulness for people who practice it. One is just mindfulness in daily life. So, for example, this morning I woke up and I went for my daily walk on the beach. And what that looks like for me is that when I get to the beach, I notice the blue of the sea. I intentionally just look at the color of the clouds, at the way that everything is moving. Now, if a thought about something, after 10 seconds of doing that, quite likely the thought, "I really need a coffee," is likely to pop into my mind. But one of the great skills of mindfulness, of staying in the present moment, is learning to observe, there's a thought. And right now my task is to just engage in the beauty of this beach. But I'm going to learn to let go of that thought. And in the same way as the clouds might be moving with the wind, I'm going to let that thought go and bring my focus back to what I'm looking at on the beach. Now, that sounds really easy. It's actually really hard to even notice when you have a thought.
Yeah.
And so that's part of the skill of it.
I see its positive impacts. I also find myself having twofold developing questions out of that. The first is, I'm a bloke who, when that thought comes into his head, needs to do something with it. Mm. It's like, that's a great thought. It might be something I've got to do when I get to work. What do I do with that transient thought? Because I've got to do something with it because I'm a bloke. I need to connect dots. Things need to have their place. And then the secondary question to that is that I'm a commuter and I get all too little time perhaps with my kids. So the day that I do get a chance to have breakfast, I don't have the space to enjoy the coconut in my cereal because I'm worried about the kids who are using the coconut as a weapon.
Yes.
tell me about those places, what I do with that stuff, because both of those are important aspects to this.
So you do have to find, obviously, the time that works for you. So it might be in the shower. The kids probably aren't in the bathroom. So, you know, that's
fair
when
point.
So that's when you practice mindfulness. Or it could be the drive to work. That you're just, you can do mindfulness of your body, just noticing where you are in the chair, looking at the different trees around. There's a lovely little skill, which if people start to get a bit anxious, there's a mindfulness exercise called Notice Five Colors. So you could be driving along and you've got some anxious thoughts coming into your mind and you think, no, I'm going to get out of my mind and just into the present moment. I'm going to notice five different colored cars and become mindful of the car. So it is a matter of finding the right place. And some people have situations in life where they're naturally mindful. A lot of blokes say that surfing is a place of mindfulness because they're not thinking. They're just in the water and enjoying it.
Mine's scuba diving.
Yep, there you go.
Same process.
Mine's gardening.
Yeah.
Other people have knitting and crocheting.
Why is mindfulness important?
Yes, which is a very good question. And I would just add one extra little thing before we get to that, which is that as well as mindfulness of daily life, there is the research, which I'm about to tell you as to why it's important, assumes that you're doing perhaps a slightly more formal mindfulness as well.
Yes.
So the research is people who spend about 20 minutes a day over about 2 months doing a thing called mindfulness of the breath, which is basically where you stop and you just try and become aware of your breathing for 20 minutes. Now, of course, a million thoughts will pop into your mind in that 20 minutes, but you just notice them and you let them go and you come back to the breath. Now, in response to that question you asked before about what you do with the thoughts, if they're important enough, they'll come back.
Okay.
No, they're not going to disappear into the ether. Trust that they will come back. I mean, if they're crucial, you might want to write them down.
Yeah.
Most of our thoughts, we think all the time, and it's inane conversation and chit-chat that we have going, and we're not even aware that we have it half the time, but it has a massive impact on our mood. So if you're really stressed and you have a whole lot of really negative thoughts, it's going on whether you're aware of it or not. So learning to let it go is very helpful. But in terms of the benefits of it, there's a massive research. So it improves your immune system. If you slow down and do something like a mindfulness of breath, and you can get great MP3 downloads, apps, CDs to help you. It's very hard to do that by yourself. You need someone talking you through it. And the daily mindfulness. Your immune system functions better. If you have a flu jab and you've been practicing mindfulness, you get a better immune response. If you're having cancer treatment and you're practicing mindfulness, your body recovers more quickly. Not only does your immune system work better, but your cortisol levels, and that's your secondary stress hormone. So when you get stressed, people, I'm sure, will have heard of fight or flight hormone adrenaline.
Yeah.
You know, you get that sort of initial urge of adrenaline. If you're under chronic stress, you get cortisol. Now, it does the yucky stuff like increase your cholesterol and your blood pressure and all that stuff. Mindfulness decreases your cortisol levels. It's not the only way. Exercise does that as well. But it does that very efficiently. And it does that partly because it can change the volume of structures in your brain. So we know that our brains are changeable, thank heavens.
Yeah.
We're not stuck with how we were at the end of our childhood. Now, some of us arrive at adult life with an enlarged amygdala. Now, an amygdala, it's hard to say, is deep in our brains and it is in charge of our emotional response to difficult situations. It gets activated when we're distressed. And it causes, in part, that surge of adrenaline and of cortisol. And people who are anxious and reactive often have very enlarged amygdalas. If you've been through a really difficult, traumatic childhood, you arrive in adulthood with an enlarged amygdala. And with perhaps less connections with your frontal lobe, which is where your lovely, calm, rational thinking exists. Now, mindfulness literally reduces the density and the volume of your amygdala, which means you're less emotionally reactive. It also changes what is active. So there's a bit just above your left eyebrow and it's called your left prefrontal cortex. And there's a lot of research by a neuroscientist called Richard Davidson, and he has discovered that these certain aspects of the left side of your brain are very active when you're in a positive mood. And mindfulness activates your left prefrontal cortex. So it's part of why it can actually help your mood. So it's used in the world of psychology as a very powerful tool in depression therapy. There was a big study out of the University of Oxford some years ago. Interestingly, the professor of clinical psychology there, Mark Williams, who started this study, is a Christian. He's an Anglican minister. So he obviously had wrestled with this Buddhist-Christian idea as well. And this is for chronically depressed people. They were receiving CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, which is the standard evidence-based therapy for depression. When they added mindfulness to it, it halved their relapse rates, which is an extraordinary result.
It is.
In the world of psychology. So it's been shown over and over again to be helpful, not only when you're already depressed, but as a preventative for depression. Because if you're less stressed, you've got more positive emotions going, God just seems to have designed our bodies to need these times where you slow down and you just are. You're not doing, you're just being. And we can see this come out in the scientific part of the research.
Listening to you speak, I can't think of any specific biblical reference, but this would seem to be a biblically based truth. While it may have seen its origins in Buddhism, for instance, I hear David in the Psalms, for instance, referring to a similar kind of process. And in fact, it would seem in some of the psalmist's writings that it's very much a case of mindfulness. The way he observes the minutiae of life, it would seem to be a practice of mindfulness in its own way. Can you share a Christian context? Because at the superficial level, it would seem to be very self-differentiating. It would seem to be, I am aware of myself, therefore I am able to heal myself. That if I notice the small things, I will be better. And yet at the heart of the Christian faith is that there is a power much greater than ours outside of ourselves.
That's true, yes.
So connect for me a faith-based perspective to mindfulness.
I think that it's a really good observation about the Psalms. And he's not only mindful of his own thoughts, but of his feelings and his emotions. And part of mindfulness is also learning to just sit with difficult feelings and learning to observe them. And I think time and time again in the scriptures, there's people don't avoid their difficult feelings. They're encouraged to look at them and see, observe them in God's presence. I think in terms of a Christian perspective, probably Ecclesiastes is also another book that's very relevant, because part of the philosophy of mindfulness is an acceptance of the ups and downs of life. So we accept that our thoughts that pop into our mind may or may not be helpful. And they may be negative, they may be positive. And we may experience negative or positive emotions. And, you know, life has its ups and downs. And, you know, you think of Ecclesiastes 3, that there's a season for everything. There's a time to weep and a time to laugh. And this sense in mindfulness of acceptance, which Buddhists sort of claim as their own in a sense, I think is equally part of Christian thinking. That in a sense, it's a more developed thinking, because we're in a fallen world, so accepting that sometimes our thoughts are difficult and they need to be let go of, or accepting that, oh gosh, I'm really anxious about this, and well, in a fallen world, there'll be things to be anxious about, that acceptance makes a lot of sense. If you look at Christian writings, perhaps a little bit outside of the purely Western tradition, and you go to Eastern Orthodox churches or even the contemplative part of Catholicism, there's a lot of history of this idea. So, for example, St. Francis in the 13th century, he talked about when he comes to pray, he notices that thoughts get in the way. And I mean, I can certainly relate to that. You suddenly start thinking about planning dinner when you're meant to be praying.
This is that moment where we feel our prayers are bouncing off the ceiling.
That's right.
Yeah.
And he talked about it, encouraging to think that it's not just us. The 13th century, he was struggling with that. And he said, look, what you have to do is just, you notice them, and without forced attention, you just let go of the thoughts and you come back to your focus on prayer. And there's a 1,000 years worth of writings of monks. These are sort of desert fathers, monks, in a collection of writings called the Philokalia. And they talk a lot about this idea of preparing yourself before prayer in a state of just being in God's presence, where you allow other thoughts to go and there's this sense of just being mindful of God's presence. So it certainly fits with other perhaps Christian heritages. And for me as a Christian, being a Christian transforms it. So when I'm at the beach, I'm not just looking at the clouds and observing the colours. There's this deep communing of thankfulness with God for the beauty of creation. Or even when I'm doing my mindful eating or mindful walking or mindful breathing, thank you, Lord, that I have breath. It's sanctified, I think.
There's very much an aspect of the Sabbath in this, isn't there?
Absolutely. It is. It's a great way of looking at it. Little glimpses of the rest, which we have to look forward to. And as I say, we just seem to be designed that with all those health benefits, it must be part of God's way of that we need to slow down and just be in the present.
I'm going to ask you a question that we may need to come back to at some point. But where are the resources that I can go that have a faith perspective attendant to them that I can do some more research and study into mindfulness?
That's a good question. There's not much around from a faith perspective. CPX have an article that I wrote. The reason I wrote that article, so CPX is the website for the Centre for Public Christianity, but it was because I couldn't find anything much around from a faith perspective on mindfulness. Mostly the secular psychological research, there is no Buddhist philosophy left. It is very much about learning to let go of unhelpful thoughts, learning to focus, learning to be calm, learning to sit with your emotions. So there's nothing un-Christian or anti-Christian in those. So if you go to a book or a website, for example, the Black Dog Institute, Beyond Blue, there's a great website called The Happiness Trap, which is by an Australian doctor and a type of mindfulness-based CBT, and he has lots of resources. I think they're very safe for Christians to go to who just want the technique and the skills. Some of the books, so John Kabat-Zinn, who's the founding father of it in lots of ways, who started up this stress reduction course years ago, some of his books are great. So Full Catastrophe Living is his description in wonderful detail of his whole stress reduction course, or very secularized. But others of his books, you have to have a few antenna out because he is a Buddhist, and so you just want to, like when you're reading any book, I guess, you just want to be looking at some of the assumptions. And I don't know how much time we've got, but there are other assumptions that you would want to have your antenna out for. So, for example, the acceptance piece in Buddhism, you just entirely accept whatever comes. It's the classic, you know, whatever is. Whereas obviously as a Christian, there'll be points where you do want to make judgments and you do want to discern what's wrong and right.
There is a call to action at some point, surely.
Exactly. Yeah. And that also relates to the detachment idea.
Yeah.
That as Christians, we're not called to be detached from the world. And while it's very helpful to observe, as you say, even King David does, observe our thoughts and observe our feelings, there's times we're called to engage. If you see injustice and you're passionately angry, you don't want to just observe your anger. You want it to motivate you to action as we, you know, participate with God in bringing his kingdom in. So I guess it's like all things, it's balancing the helpfulness of something like mindfulness and not being too sucked into the assumptions behind it.
Give me a couple of practical steps after we listen to this podcast or this radio show. Where do I begin in mindfulness and what can I do now?
Well, you can start with just that little idea of compartmentalizing the first few minutes of any activity that you can, whether it's eating in the shower, walking on the beach, driving to work, and just being aware, just trying to pull yourself into the present moment. There are, as I mentioned, some really good websites. Probably the Happiness Trap website is a great one. It's got some resources you can download and it works you step by step through some mindfulness practices, and it has some downloads. If you Google mindfulness apps, you know, there's a lot. There's a lovely one for children from 7 Up called Smiling Mind, and it works kids through this calming sort of, you know, it trains them in how to do it. So there certainly are a lot of resources out there. And if you stick to just a straight secular psychology resource as a Christian, I think you should be fine.
Lisa Aitken from Eagle Psychology. You can find more on Lisa at eaglepsychology.com.au.